Hello, I'm Ash Taylor, and welcome to the Hitting the Wall podcast. This podcast is produced by the Business Clubhouse, which is a community for business owners to come together, solve problems, and share successes. We create a safe but challenging space for individuals to work as a team to create better lives for themselves and their families. I'm also the author of the number one bestseller, Hitting the Wall, a book about winning the game of business by breaking through your own barriers. In this podcast, I interview business owners about specific walls that they have faced and how they overcame them, digging into the mindset of what's involved to run a successful business. In this week's episode, I chat to Danny Denhard from Focus, who's on a mission to change the world of work. We discuss all things culture and leadership, digging into how businesses thrive when they put culture in the workplace first. You'll learn about the power of creating personal ecosystems and why enabling conflict in the workplace is a good thing. We talk about businesses being a badge of honor, prioritizing culture before the workplace collapses, and why gossip is so important. Danny also takes us through his personal manifesto for change, why being back-to-back is damaging productivity, and whether the new habits we've created in the last 12 months are beneficial to people and businesses. Fascinating discussion. Hey, Danny, how are you?
I'm great, Ash. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. We were just chatting off air about it's kind of middle of the week again, middle of the month, and there seems to be no end in sight again. And the sort of middle of the month lull whilst we're sitting here in lockdown.
Yeah, completely. I hope people get the energy back, although it's hump day today.
Yeah, it's always Wednesday's a funny one, which is why we try and get these podcasts out on a Wednesday and hopefully get people thinking about stuff in a different way. So do you want to, we know each other through your brother, Ollie, who has been on this podcast about, God, a year ago now, if not longer. So yeah, he's someone I do a mastermind group with as well. So he's someone that one of the few people in my life allowed to challenge me a little bit, which is quite good fun, quite entertaining. And I'm sure when he listens to this, he's going to have an ear out for some of the stuff we might say. So do you want to tell me, what do you do? What's your background? Where are you now in your life? The work that you do, change you're trying to make, that sort of stuff. Do the pitch, you know what I mean?
Great. So the elevator pitch is Danny Denhard. There's only two of us in the world.
Oh, brilliant.
So I'm easy to find and easy to troll, pretty much. As you rightly said, my brother joined you in May 2020. So my past is sort of two decades of marketing growth and product leadership. The recent, as I would call it, is I led the growth department and marketing department and the crowdfunding business at Just Giving, which is that big purple platform, about 26 million people have donated to. And the now and the next, as I also call it, is I'm on a mission to fix the broken world of work. So what that basically means is fixing company culture and creating one company strategy that everyone buys into, as opposed to everyone creating their own strategies. And it just instantly deteriorates how companies perform.
Interesting. I mean, really interesting. So we were talking off air a little bit about Matthew Syed and his books that we're both a fan of. So, and you said something that I found really interesting is this whole piece about what he's written enabled you to kind of realize that what you knew had meaning and maybe help you articulate it into something of substance. So do you want to tell me about how Focus came about and the link with Matthew Syed's book as well and what happened there? Because I find that really interesting.
Sure. So I left Just Giving at the end of March 2020. So it was either the greatest time to leave or the worst time to leave. I took like a mini sabbatical essentially. And I had a pile of books that I bought from a previous holiday, and Black Box Thinking was one of them. And I just started to dive into it. And I'd read some of his newspaper columns. I'd heard him on a couple of podcasts. And I thought, this guy is super smart. He's very good at articulating things that others probably might struggle to. So I read Black Box Thinking, and I'll be brutally honest, it took me about 3 weeks. But it was more that I make notes. I'm a huge person for an internal wiki. Essentially, I have my own personal wiki that I keep and that knowledge center. And essentially what I did, I made all these notes and I went back and sort of, it just turned a light bulb on for me, and it made me go and straight away get Rebel Ideas, which is his sort of follow-up book. And Rebel Ideas, just instantly I started to read it. I couldn't stop listening to it when I was cooking, walking, doing anything I could to try and fight the first lockdown. And it just crystallized a lot of things to me. So it sounds really obvious to a lot of people, but the different environments that you're in, the different people you spend time with, the better the sort of the culture and the people and ecosystem around you is. And I've always known it, but it's just the way that he had written it and puts it across and sort of challenges how sharing information and data is really important. And every department I've looked after, or team I've looked after, or business I've worked with or consulted on, if you don't share the what I call unknown knowns, if you don't share those pieces of information, no one grows, and the companies and populations struggle, and they tend to go backwards. And it's something that just hit me, and I just knew. I started to write a manifesto in Google Docs on I think it was a Tuesday, and I've got through it really quickly, shared it to a few people, and it just really stuck. And to be honest, it's sort of a combination of Matthew Side's work, listened to a load of podcasts, and just talking to a lot of people. And in that sabbatical, it was like three things that crystallized it. And that was, I'd say, a mix between black box thinking, Rebel Ideas, and talking to about 20 different leaders just surmised it for me. And I knew that was the path I had to go on.
So it is funny how you can read or listen to something and it just makes it's like a switch in your head, isn't it? It kind of just makes you go, yeah, this is what I've been trying to say and I've not been able to say it. So I find that really, really fascinating. What are the, you know, within that manifesto, what were the sort of maybe, I don't know, two or three things that you were trying to get across when you were expressing that? Because I'm really interested to try and unpick your thoughts on culture and leadership. So I'm assuming that within that manifesto there are some guiding principles. I suppose, do you want to share those with us? Because I think that would be quite cool.
Sure. So one of the things that sort of what I call my business focus was just the world of work has lost it. Like, I think we're too busy, as in like busy is a badge of honor that everyone wears. And that was the thing that sort of stuck to many people when I released it and I got some feedback on it. And it was very much, you know, I've sat around the exec table and you listen to everyone else. And what you end up doing is you end up fighting and protecting your team as opposed to pushing the company forward. And then, you know, company culture is often always on the bottom of the agenda, but it's the thing that no one really gets to. And then something, there's a Mike Tyson quote, you know, you've got a strategy until someone punches you in the face.
Yeah.
It's kind of overused more recently, but I kind of think you don't really prioritize company culture until it blows up. And that's just the way of how busy work's become and how we've become so tool dependent. And the manifesto really sort of really became something for me. And when I was writing it, it's because of how we hide behind calendars, how other people own our time, how we enable other people to book in time slots when it's not actually that convenient. To get a good piece of work, like the Pompadoro technique is something that I tested and tried out and sort of optimized for me. And it's, you know, blocking out very dedicated sets of time. So humans only have like a set period of time where you can really focus.
Yeah.
And for me, it was, you know, between 25 and 50 minutes is where I could get things done. And also we're primed for time boxing. So it's really important that I understood that time boxing was a thing that people didn't get a chance to do and you could help it. And it all sort of came back to two things. It was strategy, so people buying into it. And then it was company culture. So knowing people were happy, knowing how to make them happier, how to make, you know, set an environment for people. And it doesn't necessarily always have to come from leadership, but someone has to coach or mentor you to improve. And that's what the manifesto really sort of shouts out for me. And, you know, that's what kind of got me down to writing it and sharing it and building videos from it and all sorts. So it's become a bit of a content machine.
But what you're talking about here is there's two things that are jumping out at me on this. One, very much as this kind of, when you have this hook, when you have this internal hook and this passion, this drive, and you have that moment, you're not creating content. All you're doing is unlocking the content that's already within you. You're just finding different ways of expressing how you feel and understand that subject. And I think people sometimes struggle to express themselves because they're still searching for that, for that hook, for that inspiration, that piece that they really can anchor themselves on and go, do you know what? This is what all my experience, all my education, all my learnings have come together and are going to enable me to make a change in the world and have an impact. So I think that's a really cool thing. And it might be that in 10 years' time, you get another hook and something else drops. But right now, this whole principle of enabling culture within the workplace and changing the way that the organizations essentially run themselves and eventually implode works for you. So yeah, chuck out all the videos you can and all the rest of it, because it's not new stuff for you. It's just you've finally kind of almost got a medium to express how you feel. Do you think that's fair?
Completely. For me, it sounds a bit cheesy, but like, I really like helping people. If there was a job that just enabled me to help smart people, I would have looked for it and done it. But I think a tiny way of helping sort of thousands of people raise so much money online, like through charities and friends, family, and that it kind of like was something that I was very lucky to be able to do, but I was even luckier to help people that I worked with. So, you know, although I was in a senior position, like coaching and mentoring was something that I personally was much better at than being per se like a big department manager or, you know, execs have got a really hard job. Like it's probably harder than it's ever been because you can't concentrate on things that you really need to concentrate on. But I knew from looking back and knowing that I helped a handful of people, I'm in a lucky and privileged position. And if I can scale that in a way that I know I can, and I know that people want, then I know I've had a milestone or a peak in my life that's happy, and I'm in a relatively privileged position to be able to do that now.
That's really cool. And it's good that you recognize that, because I think a lot of people kind of float through life doing a good job, making an impact, but they don't really recognize it. And when you recognize it, you can leverage it, I suppose, because you can do more of it and make that change. So how just coming back to the culture piece, what are your biggest frustrations about culture? And I think, you know, a lot of my audience on this podcast is the smaller, almost micro business owner. And one of the questions I often get is, I know I need to take on my first member of staff. What do I need to do? How do I make sure they're the right fit? How do I, choose someone who I'm going to get on with? And for most businesses, what people don't realize, somebody wiser than me once told me this, you know, the biggest scale you ever make is going from one to two, both emotionally and actually in terms of practical change. You know, you're having to share your passwords with somebody for the first time. You're having to share an office with somebody for the first time. There's all these firsts when you take on your first member of staff. Whether that's outsourced or a full-time employee, you know, the world is going towards much more sort of freelance-based stuff now. I appreciate that. But even then, I think the question is valid, because I believe that within our business, I'm not sure I would I use the word culture? Possibly. We've certainly got shared values, but different skill sets within the team. And we've done some bits of work. The book launch was a great example where, you know, the team pulled together and did an incredible amount of work. But they all felt like it was a game. It was fun for them. You know, they worked hard and there was some challenges, but there was never any moment of anyone saying, I don't want to do this. You know, everyone was full in. They were choosing to do the work to make it happen and come up with other ideas. So what's your kind of message what message would you give to people when they were in that situation trying to take someone on for the first time? What do you look for? How do you create that culture first rather than waiting for it to explode? So a really long way of getting to the question, but
so for me, it's like, especially if you're a small, mid or large company, the most important thing is to get the right team around you. So whether that's an employee, friends, you know, mentors, etc. And I would often challenge people when they would say, oh, I'm really bad at hiring, or I'm really bad at X. You know, you have to be very specific in what you're hiring, who you're hiring, and why. And you can't build a culture until you've got, you know, you've got people. So you can create principles and you can create ideas, but you really need the people around you to help, you know, co-create it and establish something that works. So, you know, with your book launch, for instance, everyone had their specific job and their role, and it sort of tied in together. And, you know, most of it's probably a much bigger team effort than people realize.
Mm.
But actually, it's probably because people knew what they were supposed to do. They knew what made them successful, and they knew what made the company successful. And often, you know, people want their personal growth, professional growth. They want psychological safety. And we're tribal as a human species. Humans look for tribes because that's how we survived around the campfire. So as long as you know that you're part of the right tribe, people will go over and above. So big, small, or massive companies, they tend to, the hiring manager tends to want to hand things off and wants to supply a load of work that either they're not great at, or they want offered to someone else, or they know they're awful at it and they just need that skill set to be supplemented. So for me, it's a case of understanding how to make someone successful, how to make the business successful, how to improve the business and the person, and how do you bring it all together under something that you all agree on. So I always recommend, first thing I recommend to people, I've been asking them a load of questions, is to write some principles. So it's on one page that you all agree on. And and how do you move forward? So for instance, Ash, you went on holiday for 2 weeks, or you had to go away for 3 days. What is it that's going to be their guiding light, their compass to help them succeed? So often it's knowing what to do when the other person isn't around, or when people aren't around, so small, medium, or large businesses. So that's what I would suggest, and that's how I would start building the foundations for subcultures and cultures and that in businesses.
So there's two things, really interesting. There's two things that jump out at me straight away. Okay, so answer this if you can, and it might, I don't know if it's a yes, no, or a clear answer, but does culture drive having the right people in the business, or do people drive having the right culture?
If you've ever worked anywhere and you think you've built the perfect team, it can be something as silly as the wrong hyphen, or can be something as silly as the wrong hex color that can blow up things really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
A very quick antidote. I worked somewhere where we made a web change, and it was trivial, very small. It had a huge internal impact for 3 weeks, and it took a massive argument, like a curated argument. So something that we deliberately had to manufacture to get people on the same team again. But a silly little thing. So I think you can prepare culture as much as you want, and you can build the right principles, but people have bad days, people have good days. It's just how it happens. It's how you react as company culture for me. It's how you interact as people, how you can get through hurdles and, you know, barriers like you've said before. I think that's what company culture is, and that's how you know you can be successful. So I think there's no right or wrong on that, but I do think you have to have the right group of people. Some humans just don't get on. It's as simple as that. So, you know, it's how you react for me is how you make successful company culture, or the right subcultures within a company.
So you interesting point there, you know, fact, some people just don't get on. So how do you go about, I know you've talked about the guiding principles, and that's fine, because it's all great having a piece of paper that has those principles on it. And yes, we all agree to them, but yeah, people mess up. You can have challenges that occur, and it's quite easy sometimes to forget that piece of paper exists, especially in the heat of the moment. So how do you create, and I'm coming back to Matthew Syed's book here, Rebel Ideas as well, how do you go about creating a team that has a culture where that forced debate environment, forced is, I don't know if that's the right word, but that debate environment where you get, where you get cognitive dissonance going on, where you get that diversity happening. How do you create that when people inherently want to be liked and don't really want conflict? You know, how do you force conflict into a situation where conflict is not really wanted, but it's the best thing to produce culture? Does that make sense?
Because I think there's a combat and conflict, which a lot of people teach. So a lot of the time it's down to sentiment, right? So being combative tends to mean sort of banging heads and forcing something. Conflict can be enabled to have, conversation and the right conversation. I think it comes down to you as a, like, if you're a leader trying to address it or trying to move things forward, I think you need to understand people at a human level. So you need to understand them individually and you need to know their motivations. If I was ever going to say the best way to understand people is just to know how they're motivated. So if you're an introvert, an ambivert or an extrovert, everyone's going to be motivated differently. Sure. So I would say, like, know people's stages. So know how they can be on stage. So some people, extroverts, will love an argument because it enables them to step up and not perform and be this different person. Whereas introverts can be the greatest people when it comes to conflict or combat because they've taken a step back, they've digested what people have wanted to say, and then they can be far more articulate when they want to be or when it has to happen. You know, I know I'm ambiverted. When I need people, I'll go to them, but when I don't want them, I'll run away and sort of get back in my shell. Yeah. And that's, some teams need an extroverted leader because they need someone who's going to put on a performance and be strong and talk it through. So for me, it's a way of enabling the right conversation, but also telling people that it's being able to be confident enough to say, we're going to have this conversation. If you're confident now or comfortable now, it's the right time to be able to come back and have your say. And it's for a chairperson to go around and ask everyone's opinion.
Yeah.
So, Dave, what do you think? Ahmed, what do you think? Sarah, what do you think? Sarah, what do you think? It's really important that you go around, and you ask people their opinion. Some people aren't ever going to be confident or comfortable in talking in front of a group. But you can always say, here's 30 minutes where you can go away, digest it. You might be a data-driven person. You might be a very specific personality type. Go away, digest it, and then come back. And then we're going to have round two if we need to.
Yeah. So you need to create space for the reflectors, for instance.
But it has to be safe, right? So it has to be safe for everyone. And I think that's what a lot of businesses have lost. And I know the world of remote and forced working from home is difficult for everyone. But people miss their desk. They miss their work identity. They miss their coffee cup. Mm. They miss their people. They miss tiny little things like arguing over a meeting room. And did you book that? Like silly things that companies will go through. People miss that. So knowing all these little weird and wonderful nuances will really help you to create a high performing team. And you can have, I think gone are the days of the brilliant asshole that, people used to call it. And I think gone are the days that people accept it. But some people can be brilliant and they don't have to be the other half of it. But some people's brilliance really brings up the rest of the team and helps everyone else perform at a higher level, a higher standard. So if you know that you can pull that out, or if you know someone's desperate to step up, it's how you motivate them, how you nudge them in the right way to do that. So for me, it's knowing people's motivations, knowing how they operate and why they operate the way that they do. And a lot of people just don't know that, like from managers to colleagues, they just don't know each other well enough. So something I've put out and the newsletters I put out every week is to help people understand that driver.
It's not something we're taught, is it? Certainly not at school, certainly not, unless you go out and specifically study leadership or maybe do an MBA or something where you get the right cohort and that enables that sort of thinking. But we almost have to discover it. and through reading, through podcasts, as you talked about it. And, you know, it sounds like a lot of your, I'm not dismissing your skill set, but a lot of it has been, it sounds like self-taught, because you've absorbed the right material and reflected on it in the right way and pulled it together in a methodology that you know, is impactful and actually works. And I think the reason I mention that is because I'd like your opinion on this. There's a lot of talk at the moment, whilst we're in lockdown 3.0, whatever we want to call it, 1.3, that this whole remote working thing will be here to stay. And if not permanently, an element of it will be here to stay. And there's you know, I know my wife is already talking about, well, what can she do when they go back to work from home a day, 2 days a week, you know, whatever it is. But to me, I think there's an element of having lost the water cooler moment. You know, those the chats that don't happen in the meeting room, that aren't forced, but are in passing. And I know Matthew Syed talks about some of the, and I can't be exact, but the chapter on Silicon Valley and how much of the growth that was, the accelerative growth that was made, was because of the informal conversations in cafeterias and in the pub after work time. That's where the magic actually happened, not during the paid hours, if you like, but the conversations that were happening between competitive teams and competitive businesses, because the developers didn't care about keeping things close to their chest and the rest of it. They were just sharing ideas because they were getting geeky about it. And then they were able to go away and implement it. So do you think there's a danger that if we facilitate too much remote working, that we're going to lose that kind of those opportunities for accelerative growth because of the way that humans interact on a gossip-based level, fundamentally?
It's funny you say gossip, because probably September time, I said that gossip is the thing that people miss the most. And that's the informality of being able to have something and talk it through. And I think that's why so many people on social media end up arguing. It's because there's a lot of, the ability to gossip releases a lot of frustration, releases humor, releases something completely different. What I'd say is, getting back to the world of remote work, or, you know, we're going to be in a hybrid model in, say, 6 to 9 months' time. Mm-hmm. We're going to get a lot of, from some research, some people say it's 30% in office, 70% out of office. So that could be from home, that could be remote, it could be in a satellite office. So for me, when I researched this and put a sort of an ebook together last year, and I think around it a lot now, is I think hybrid's going to be the way that we all decide to work. I think gone are the days where people want to be in office 5 days. People were already rushing away from the office 1 day a week to get their head down, to get stuff done.
Yes, the office has become the unproductive environment, hasn't it?
Yeah. So the way I used to explain it, it was the part that is the place that you never sat at your actual desk. Mm. It was the place where you went and sat in various meeting rooms, and it was very deliberate in doing that. And, or, you know, it's sort of a feature of broken work, essentially. So I think what will happen in a remote world or a hybrid world is the office is going to turn into an arena. I think the office is going to be very performative. I think the office is going to have the best equipment. So whether that's lighting or, you know, audio setup or video setup or tech, I think it's going to have to be the place where people go on and make it available to thousands of people, whether they're in person or they're virtual.
Yeah,
there's huge amounts of investment gone into the virtual HQ already. There's a load of tools that are available there. But I think there's a way that a hybrid model or asynchronous can work. And I think that's basically where you have more informal areas of drop-ins. I think they're going to be open rooms. It'll be less intrusive than Zoom is. But it'd be based on video tech or audio tech. So there's a load of things like Around and Loom and stuff like that, tools that you can already record a snippet or a bubble of your head and send it over for an update. there's already people that are picking up the Teams call or the Slack call or phoning through WhatsApp or their mobile and having conversation with their colleagues like they used to. But I think what it's done is it's made messier dynamics within the office. And I think what that's done is it's just made people realize that you're a colleague of someone, you're an acquaintance of someone, or you're a friend or like a BFF or someone at work. And I think it's really strained a lot of ties between people that thought they were friends, but they've actually just worked out they were colleagues. And I think what the watercolor moment and replacing that will do, and there's loads of ways of doing that. I think people will do on-sites, they won't do off-sites anymore. I think there'll be people and companies that will be deliberate in going back into the office to try and build that back out. And one of the recommendations I made to, you know, mid to large size company recently was, when you can, I'd recommend that you do one on-site at least every fortnight, where you can get people in safely and you can get them talking. And then they, you know, people have to book in and book out. And I actually think the office is going to be, most office spaces will have to stay about the same size, but it'd be about 40% less desks. There'd be 40% less sort of closed meeting rooms. I think it'd be more open and more deliberate. And I think that would enable people to walk past each other or arrange an informal conversation. Like, the removing that and being really deliberate in communications is the most important thing for offices. I do think the gossip and the walk column moment is really important, but I think the struggle for some people will be, I'm not going to want to spend as much time as I used to do that. Or it would be, we're going to be deliberate and we're going to meet up for lunch, or we're going to have the afternoon where we have a little bit more informal work time.
So I think it sounds like what you're saying, that in order to maintain culture, we're almost going to have to organize our water cooler times to a degree. Is we're going to have to give some thought as leaders to how we actively facilitate the opportunity for gossip moments, you know, where people can get together, rather than hoping that it will happen through chance. And because we're working remotely, there are less opportunities for that to happen. So we've kind of got to create them on people's behalf.
Yeah, I think, you know, the opportunities is the perfect word. It's just creating those opportunist times where people can do that. When you're on back-to-backs, it's impossible to even make a cup of tea sometimes. There's like, you know, like TikToks and Instagram reels, etc., that people time themselves trying to do it between the back-to-backs. So I think actually when that slows down and becomes more methodical, I think there'll be more opportunities for the informalities. I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity where it comes down to people can have that less, you know, it can be less planned, but it can be more deliberate in having those moments of time where they can have those conversations. But I think it's a bit like, I honestly think there should be less managers within businesses and more coaches and more mentors. I think people aren't coached well enough. Any high performing team typically has 1 or 10 coaches. Businesses don't. And I think, interestingly, I think that's where people will land. And I also do think there'll be a big surge in 4-day work weeks. And I think there'll be people that work out to understand that actually you can get the same amount of work done in less time.
And it's, I agree with you, because I think, you know, coming back to the back-to-back piece, am I working more than I was before? Probably. I certainly watched my wife, you know, she's back-to-back most of this afternoon, was back-to-back. You know, that's become another term, hasn't it, that we've picked up in the last year, back-to-back. Whereas, you know, she's going from meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting without having to move to another meeting room. Or shall I come to your desk, or will you come to my desk? Or actually, why don't we do it over coffee? Or, you know, we need to go off site to a law firm or whatever for one of our meetings. So you've got that travel aspect that's disappeared. So people are having more meetings with fewer gaps in between, which is on one side you could say is making them more productive, but I think it's making people less productive, because you're not getting the opportunity to switch off and reset and reframe the conversation that you're going into and have those reflective moments. So I know she'll get to the end of the day and she's like, well, I know I've had 8 meetings today, but I can't tell you what happened in any of them. And she has to go through her notes because there hasn't been any opportunity for that to actually percolate down and sit and actually gel properly. And I think we're really missing something there. I think we're not allowing our brains to be in a position where they can work the way they're supposed to work, which is to allow us time to actually assimilate the information that, you know, I can't do this podcast and then go off and do another one straight away. I've tried it, and doing them back to back is really hard. I need a good 5-10 minutes in between just to kind of come down off the back of it.
Some of the tips I give people around that is have 25 minute meetings by default, not 30.
Yes.
Start meetings at 10:07, not 10.
Yeah.
Random times help, like cognitively, by setting the default, your time box in, and that helps people get to an answer quicker. Or know that they can come back. If a meeting isn't flowing the right way in 6 minutes, kill it. Like, there's all these different ways of addressing it. Completely agree with you. Back to backs don't allow people to digest and really go away and think and order their thoughts and focus it. I have learned, and you know, I'm an interim CMO and do some COO work and do some growth advisory. I know if I don't shut my laptop and even go for a walk in the apartment, or I don't go for a walk outside, often I'll miss some things, even if I've made notes or I haven't been able to think that through. And working with teams recently, you just realize that actually they need to go and make a cup of tea like they would have done. It's about replicating behaviors that you're used to. So although it takes 88 days to change a complex habit, we're way past that now. So what we need to do is set a new, we need to form a new set of behaviors and habits. And to do that, we need to reset. But I think it really needs a coach, or what I call you could have a culture community manager that comes in and helps you arrange culture and arrange how people operate and interact. Or you get someone that comes in and completely breaks down all of your meetings and reviews it and then builds a load of principles for you or collaborates with you. But there's a lot of people who have had to decide whether they're doing it right or wrong. And it's just the way they've been able to manage. But come May, June, I think that will change again. And I think there'll be what I call a hidden leader, someone that does it already, that hasn't really spoken to many people, but speaks to a lot of people, influences them, but without a formal title. I think you'll get a lot of people that are operationally smart that'll be able to unpick and solutionize a lot of these problems for you. But yeah, it's something that we need as humans, but we're just not very good at doing it ourselves. If someone tells us to do it, we probably don't want to do it, but we'll end up doing it. We'll get there. It's the 25% bias. Like, as soon as we hit 25%, we start copying 1 in 4 people, back to backs will start going.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's interesting what you said about, you know, 88 days to complex habits, but you can start creating a simple habit as quickly as 20 days and 7, some people would argue, but I kind of think about 21 days is about right. And I think what I find fascinating about that is that a lot of people talked about, you know, last March, when we went into the first lockdown, people talked about, you know, what new habits do you want to create? This is an opportunity, 3 months, 90 days. There were a lot of people out there spouting, you know, 90 days is what you need, or 88 to create a new habit. What is it going to be? Are you going to be fitter? Are you going to be healthier? Or, you know, all the rest of it. But we seem to have kind of started that, but not followed it through. So we've kind of broken the habit in terms of sending the message before it's been established. But the fact of the matter is, people have established new habits, but they've not done them consciously. They've not done them in a productive, aligned way with what their vision for the way they want their life to be like. So they've fallen into, use that phrase, they've fallen into new habits because of the way of working. So I think there's going to be a little bit of work to do in terms of breaking the back-to-back culture, because it's now a habit for people. You know, if Kate said to me, I've got 7 meetings back-to-back in the office, I'd have gone, are you nuts? And she'd have gone, oh, yeah. If I say that to her now, she's like, well, it's just the way it is. That there's a new cultural habit that's been established, I think, within the organisations.
If I'll be 100% honest, it used to be something that anyone from, you know, mid to, you know, a small to mid-sized business probably were doing anyway. And it just wasn't in your calendar, and it just wasn't on Zoom. I know Zoom fatigue, and I call it Zoombies. Like, we all turn into it. It's performative every time.
Mm.
But I think, interestingly, I think it was happening for a lot of people. They just didn't know it, but a lot of execs knew it, but they weren't proactive in trying to attack it. I think now is the time to say, actually, we need to change it. And interestingly, you know, BMAP, which is Professor Fogg's methodology, is really interesting. It's all around behavior and triggers. And I would highly recommend anyone actually read his book, Tiny Habits. But it's completely true. And you need, within your organization or your business or your life, you need to have the right intentions. You need to be motivated to do it. And you need tiny little habits to change that. And I, interestingly, you know, I challenged what Google came out with in December, which was have no meeting weeks. But that fills everyone with dread, because that's how they think they got work done, as opposed to actually getting work done by sitting and actually writing or typing or speaking or articulating the problem. And I agree. I think there'll be a fundamental shift in that. But I think it's going to need to come either from the leadership, or it's going to have to come from a really open conversation. And the only way you get around that is going asynchronous at the moment. It's been very deliberate, having the right software or the right tools to enable you to have very specific ways of communicating. So it's like being deliberate in this is what we're trying to achieve, why we're doing it, how we're doing it, where we're going to do it, and this is how we're going to update it. So things like Basecamp, which seemed very rudimentary 6-12 months ago, it's probably built in the right way now. You know, they don't have meetings for no reasons. Like, no. They basically fight you against having them. And I think businesses will have to do the same.
It's being brave enough to do things like cancel meetings if there's nothing in the on the agenda that hasn't changed. It's being brave enough to have the same meeting agenda each week so that you're actually able to track progress. It's being brave enough to have meeting agendas that don't have any other business on them. Because I mean, that's a golden rule of mine. You know, if it's not on the agenda, well, we're not talking about it. It's not, you know, if your name's not on the list, you're not coming in fundamentally. You've got to have highlighted this is something that needs addressing, and it has to fit within the parameters of the goals we've set that we want to accomplish over the next 3 to 4 months. I work in 3 terms and try and have the summer off. So, you know, we're currently running January through to Easter, basically, and we've got three things we want to achieve. So all the work's aligned to doing that. Everybody in the team knows what they're doing, hopefully. They tell me, I just turn up, which is great. But if we end up talking about stuff that sits outside of that, we're very good at stopping ourselves and say, well, this is pointless because we're not doing this at the moment. So we'll park it and talk about it after Easter, or talk about it in our review meeting in the Easter holidays when we plan the next quarter. So I think there's some lessons to be learned there about actually reflecting on meeting habits, if you like, and what's perceived to be acceptable, but not necessarily as productive as maybe we thought those things could be. So there's a you know, something around that. What do you just a question I'd like to ask you, because not asked anybody this before, but I'm going to ask you because I think it'd be interesting. If you could pick 3 must-read books, either to listen or to read, not necessarily on culture and leadership, I suspect your leaning will be in that sort of direction. What would you, you know, if you were advising somebody who was starting a business or was going into leadership perhaps, and you know, what were the 3 books that you think would be most impactful in helping enable them be a great leader or establishing a great culture?
If it's 3 books in general, I'd say The Dip by Seth Godin. It's about 80 pages long. It's tiny. Yeah. I give it to everyone I mentor or coach. It's cheap. Buy it and read it.
I observed you mentioned Tribes earlier, and that's another Seth Godin tome. It's quite a small light read. I like that. It's a good book.
So The Dip, I would say Rebel Ideas by Matthew Syed.
I recommend that to everyone as well.
Yeah. So something like there's three books that everyone recommends in culture and stuff like that. Work Rules, it's by someone who's ex-Google. It's quite good. If you're like mid to large size, it's sort of a must read for you. There's Five Dysfunctions of a Team, which is Patrick Lencioni. The Disadvantage is probably a little bit better actually for that. But I wouldn't, if it depends on your size, like I wouldn't go into that, those types of books, because they're written for very specific audiences. And if you're smaller, it seems out of reach. And if you're big, it kind of seems too small to do, but they're two sort of books. The third one that I would probably recommend around leadership, I would actually say, if I can cheat a little bit, I would probably say to listen to a podcast series. And it's called the High Performance Podcast.
Okay, yeah.
And it's, I would probably say that will give you more benefit because it tells you about individuals and teams as opposed to try and craft or create. And I think it gives you, for instance, I'm a little bit of a rugby fan. I watch it if it's on, you know, if the Six Nations are World Cup or, you know, it's on. But I find the world of rugby fascinating because it's so similar to business.
Yeah.
One's just come to me that I'm kicking myself for not saying. It's called 11 Rings by Phil Jackson. And it's NBA coach from the Lakers and the Bulls. And he managed Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant, and then also managed Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen at the same time. And they're the best. That's the best read for managers.
Interesting. Some really useful stuff there. I suspect you and I could sit in a room over several beers and chew the cud all day long. You know, we enjoy the same readings, the same listening things, the same things that we listen to and stuff like that. And both recognize the power of kind of spending time with people who challenge you but think differently to you, you know. And that was the big thing for me in Rebel Ideas. You know, I've been talking a long time about, you know, who you hang around with matters and surround yourself with. You know, I love your phrase, or his phrase, or the phrase of, you know, you're having the right personal ecosystem around you. And I think I feel very I don't know the word privileged, but it has been a privilege listening to you and adding you to that ecosystem. I think that's been, you know, really interesting for me, and some time very, very well spent. So thank you, Danny. Thank you very much for coming on board, giving up some of your Pomodoro time to share with everybody.
Thank you.
If people want to chat to you, you know, there's leaders listening to this and they want to get you involved or just pick your brains or, you know, get on your list and listen to you and read your content. What's the best way to do that? Because I'm sure people would really benefit from accessing what you're publishing and the content you're producing.
So I'm super simple to find. So Danny Denhold, anywhere. So you can go to dannydenhold.com/LinkedIn or dannydenhold.com/Twitter, and you'll just, you know, find me straight away. I'll redirect it to the platforms. My website is focus.business, and the manifesto is almost basically on the homepage, and it's in the top nav so people can read it. And I've got two weekly newsletters that I do. So there's mustreads.co.uk, and it's 10 to 15 handpicked, curated stories I read every week that you probably haven't seen in your feeds, which I call must reads because they are. And I do a leader's letter, which is every week I send on a Monday morning, I send a letter to leaders to focus on 1 to 3 things this week. And that's blog.focus.business/leaders.
Brilliant, Danny. Thank you so much for coming on. Great to chat to you. I know that I'll be well received and people will enjoy listening to that. Some fascinating stuff in there and great discussion. Cheers, buddy.
Thanks, Ash.
You've been listening to the Hitting the Wall podcast with me, Ash Taylor. This podcast is produced by the Business Clubhouse. The Business Clubhouse is a great community of business owners who share ideas, challenge and support each other to run better businesses for themselves and their families. If you'd like to grow your business with the right people around you and with the right tools to help you, visit thebusinessclubhouse.co.uk, where you can request a complimentary copy of the best-selling Hitting the Wall.